From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. It's Idaho Matters. It's also Wednesday, and that means it's time for our Doctor Roundtable. This week, well, the price of the Moderna COVID vaccine could be going up, and what we know about long COVID may not be quite as accurate as we first thought. Joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. And if you have a public health question, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Hey, Dr. Pate, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Samantha?
I'm okay. So Moderna said this week it wants to quadruple the price of its vaccine to $130. We're talking about the COVID vaccine, which caused some concern among many. So let's look at this and find out if this is a good thing or a bad thing or a logical thing. Tell me what you know.
Well, there are certainly arguments to both sides. And of course, how things happen in the United States is most of these drug makers are actually publicly traded companies. And so if you're running a publicly traded company, your obligation is to maximize returns to investors. So in that sense, the drug companies are not acting in a way other than what you should expect with those kind of financial incentives. On the other hand, is the issue that the United States has been grappling with for a long time, and that is, how do we ensure that medicines are affordable? When pharmaceutical companies are trying to maximize profits, yet we're trying to make sure that everybody can have access to these drugs. It's further complicated that by the fact that most major countries of the world negotiate prices. And in fact, if they can't get a sufficient negotiation, a lot of times they just don't even offer that medication in that country. The United States has decided long ago and has continued that trend in large part that, no, we're not going to negotiate for drugs for the Medicare program, and we're pretty much going to include everything. So that's how you end up with things like, for example, what's been in the news about insulin prices, which are outrageously high. And so recently, we all saw the action that the government took to limit that price to no more than $35, which is really important when you're talking about a life-saving drug like insulin. But we continue in this country to have this debate about, are we going to allow drug makers to charge whatever they want? In fact, the United States ends up, in general, paying way more for these drugs than other countries do. It's a problem we've got to come to grips with.
Well, this is I remember this debate over EpiPens at one point, you know, where the price went up dramatically. Some will remember by a CEO of a drug company who raised the price dramatically. Those are the pens you use if you're allergic to bees or for other sorts of things. And that, too, was a concern because, you know, people need those to survive an incident. And when the price shot up to, I think it was $400 a pop, that was a big problem. But, you've got drug companies to play to point out what they would say or have said. You know, they're putting a lot of money into R&D to get these drugs out there.
And that's what the threat is always when the companies come and testify before Congress, is that, well, if we can't have these kinds of prices, then you're taking away the incentive for us to make those investments in those drugs into development, research and development. I think that argument, there is some merit to that argument, but that argument is also overblown, because if you look at the amount of money that the major drug companies put into research and development, it still is more than amply made up by the drugs that do tend to go to the market. So it's a challenging discussion. There's certainly points to both sides. One of my personal points of view on this is I'm just not sure why the United States needs to be the only major country contributing to those research and development costs when the whole world benefits from these drugs. So I think we need to continue to work to try to find solutions. The other thing that happens, just like you were mentioning with the EpiPens, you know, again, it's really important when we're talking about a life-saving drug, and especially EpiPens are often really important for children with very serious allergies who could die. And so what we typically see when the prices become prohibitive is that people they use medications way past their expiration date, so we're not clear whether those drugs are going to be effective. And we also see people who end up, cutting doses or cutting the amount of their medicine. For example, if they're supposed to take a whole pill, maybe they'll cut it in half so they can stretch it out longer. These are not good things because oftentimes when these drugs are very important to controlling their medication or their health problem, what happens is if they do that, then they end up in the hospital. And now we're talking about a much more costly complication to take care of. So it's a significant issue that really needs a lot of bipartisan effort to address.
Correct. And it's not a solution to just quash the price on the EpiPens or on the insulin, because then you get into a debate, whose drugs do we force companies to drop the price on? And then, you're sort of playing God, because you're going to, you help out folks who have diabetes that they need the insulin, but what about someone with a cancer drug who needs the cancer drug? I mean, it's a slippery slope, and you can't do it all unless, as you said, we change the system.
That's right. And when you mess with the system, you always have to think about what are the unintended effects. So, for example, where the government could negotiate Medicare prices down, then what's to keep the companies from increasing the costs to the private market people that are not on government programs? So there's a lot of moving parts here. It's going to take some careful consideration. I think there are some interesting ideas about how to approach this problem, but we really need bipartisan work to come to a solution.
Well, we can hope for that. Let's talk about this Slate article that has come out about long COVID. It's a very interesting article. It talks a lot about studies that have been going on about long COVID, including some things that say that maybe it's not as prevalent as we thought, or it resolves faster than we thought. But there's also a lot in here about how do I want to put this? Thinking about a disease or a symptom like long COVID in terms of social media. So folks go on social media and have symptoms and it gets blown up and creates a lot of articles. How do we separate what social media is saying versus what we're getting in studies? And I think the Slate article tries to break a little of that down. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it does. I do think the Slate article is a bit oversimplified. And I say that because of this. First of all, we have to understand that even at this point in our pandemic, we still don't have a universally accepted definition of what long COVID is. Mm-hmm. And so that's number one. Number two is that the more we are learning about it, the more we're learning that this is probably not a single condition. In other words, it's not a condition where we can do a test to say, yes, you've got this. So for example, if I want to know if you have diabetes, well, I can check your blood sugars. If I want to know if you have hypertension, I can check your blood pressures. But we don't really have that for long COVID. And I think what we see is that there's a myriad of presentations of long COVID. And certainly, as the Slate article points out, there are some that are more life-limiting and disabling and distressing than some of the other symptoms. And so we see a spectrum here in terms of how disabled people may be. The good news that the Slate article points out is that up to this point, you know, there is hope for many people with long COVID. While some symptoms do persist, there are other cases where it does seem that with time, weeks, months, up to a year, many of those symptoms either resolve or get better. Now, there's some caveats there. One is that it's really hard to do this research because if we don't have a test for it and we don't have a universally agreed definition, and a lot of people who do have long COVID don't want people to know it because they're trying to go on with their lives, how do we conduct really good studies that give us good information? Mm-hmm. The other limitation to this study that we, while it certainly does present some good news, is we have to keep a very important point in mind. And that is, number one, we do see different risks for long COVID with different variants. And we don't know what's coming our way. And number two is that all of our research so far is telling us that there are going to be worse outcomes with reinfections. At the point a lot of these studies were done, it was still at a point in our pandemic where most people had only had one infection. We are now getting to the point where most people have had, on average, two infections. But within that, we all know people have had four or five. And the question is, what is going to happen? What is the cumulative risk associated with reinfections? We do know some outcomes are worse, but we don't really know the answer to that question. So while I do think there's some positive points in that Slate article, I would take it with a grain of salt because the answer's not in, and we're going to have to wait to see. Things could change over time.
And the article is Long COVID Comes Into the Light. We'll put a link to it on our website, boisestatepublicradio.org, if you want to check it out. And I think you're saying a few things that I think we've talked about before. One of them is COVID is just an animal that we're not familiar with. COVID has done things that no one expected. It created things that no one had planned for. And you have talked about in the past, both on the show and on your blog, about some of the physical effects in the brain, in the other parts of the body that folks have found from COVID. And we've said this, I don't know, a million times. It's not like the flu. It can, in some people, obviously not in everyone, create these kinds of changes in the body that were just nobody was expecting. And I think it's also important to, as you have said many times, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, you know, based on what effect COVID has done to our bodies. You know, what's going to happen in the future? Are we going to end up getting something, you know, further down the line that because it's so new, nobody knows about?
Well, yes, that's entirely correct, Samantha. Those are some of my concerns. Maybe we won't find anything disturbing in the future, and that'd be fantastic. But I, at this point, would not be prepared to say so. I would also say that there's a lot of people out there with consequences to their health from COVID that haven't been diagnosed correctly. In fact, for example, this past week, I talked to parents of a daughter who got infected and her life has dramatically changed. She saw the doctor and the doctor diagnosed her with anxiety. I looked at the video findings of this poor girl, and I can tell you this is not anxiety. This girl has a serious problem that would fall in that category of long COVID, but more serious than what we usually see. And in fact, I've just gotten her to a center of excellence to get help and find out what's going on. But we have a lot of people whose symptoms, either by themselves, they're thinking, well, I'm just tired, I'm not getting enough sleep or exercise or whatever, or they may be getting misdiagnosed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so we got an email in from G from Boise, who says, I've had all the boosters, including the bivalent booster, about 6 months ago. And G says, my doctor says there's no direction for future COVID immunizations. They're planning a trip in a few weeks. G is over 70 and immunocompromised. So what should G do? Get another bivalent booster? I mean, we're kind of floating in a free area, because we're not sure what's coming next with either COVID variants or COVID boosters.
Well, we are, and you're exactly right, Samantha, and it's very frustrating to a number of us. I fit in the same category, not about immunocompromised, but as far as when my last booster was, and people in my age group and those people like this listener who are maybe particularly at risk are asking this question. And unfortunately, the FDA committee that needs to act on this has agreed that we need to move to some standardized recommendations for 2023, and that in fact, it may be that people over a certain age or those that are at increased risk, like this listener, should have a booster at that 6 month period. But here we are, and we don't have an official recommendation. So it's very frustrating. And I do think, given that we know there's waning of that protection, we need the government to act very soon and come out with these recommendations. They can change later, but we need something for right now. And there's many of us who would like to get another booster, but that's not possible under the current rules right now. For that listener, I would be very concerned, and I particularly need to know where that person's traveling to. We are seeing a new variant. We've talked about this before, that when we talk about immune evasive, there's three parts of our immune system to think about this very simply. And we've been dealing with variants that have learned how to get around one part. There is now a new variant in some countries that has now figured out a way to get through a second part of the immune system. Mm-hmm. So, and she may be particularly at risk. So it would in large part depend on where she's going to be traveling and what she's going to do as to specific recommendations. But I would tell her that, yes, she needs to have heightened concern, take extra precautions, because her vaccine likely has significantly waned, and she sounds like she's going to be a person at high risk if she does get infected.
Good advice. Good advice. We've been speaking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. If you have a COVID-19 question for our Dr. Roundtable, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu, and we'll ask our doctor next week. Thank you so much for being here and breaking it down for us, Dr. Pate.
Oh, you're sure welcome, Samantha. Take care.
I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. You're listening to Idaho Matters.
Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.